You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm back doing a normal show after 2 weeks in a row of fund drive funness, which was great. Raised just about $800 on this show during those 2 hours. Thanks to everyone who called in and became a member. Now it's back to a normal, as much as we ever do a normal show here, a normal show. So I would love to take some calls this morning. I really like doing that. And the fund drive always reminds me how easy it is. So if you want to call in and talk about the subject today, which is a short history of women. I'm not going to do a whole history of, half of humans. But going to talk about that. It's Women's History Month. It has been for all of March. International Women's Day is March 8th. And that's something I if you follow the show on Facebook, if you don't, you can at facebook.com/praxisradio. I posted there that says it's Women's History Month here in the U.S. Does that mean that the other 11 months are Men's History Month? That's what I always tend to think of when we have the, same with Black History Month is kind of implies that the rest of the time is White History Month. The rest of the time for women, apparently, we're being part of Men's History Month. And that's obviously an oversimplification, but there's also a lot of truth to it. I have a large circle of people who are either former or current students in women's and gender studies. And a typical thing that they'll hear from folks, always male, who are being required to take a class within the program, like a basic gender studies class. The question comes up, why isn't there men's studies? Well, if you think about from an academic perspective, most history, most philosophy, most of the sciences will, if they're talking about with the sciences, it's not as relevant, I guess. But when we study the history of science, when we look at philosophy, anthropology, political science, the ideas that we're learning about are the ideas of men through history, with little exception. And in the case of the exceptions, they're presented as an exception. You'll get, the classic is, taking a philosophy class, and it goes chronologically, because that's how that subject is studied most of the time. Same with history. And then you'll get this special little thing that pops up that's women in philosophy. They're not presented in the timeline where they were actually thinking and working. They're presented as a separate category because there's a myth that there's so little of their work survived. So they're treated as the special case, and that's true in many other. We'll learn about special women in history during March, during Women's History Month, but the rest of the time, they're kind of on the sideline. There's been a lot of work, kind of in the Howard Zinn vein, the people's history vein of bringing those stories out. The women who are behind the scenes of a lot of things happening. A lot of the time, there were women resisting certain changes that happened through history, because, as I'll probably argue today, I think in some ways, in a society like this, women are better equipped to come up with solutions and to resist certain types of oppression. So that's where we're going to go. So Women's History Month every year, I was reading a little bit about it, has a theme, and I need to open that up, but this year's theme is Women of Character, Courage, and Commitment. And I haven't looked much at the actual Women's History Month website to see who the women they single out are. I know some of the ones I would single out, and I talk about them a lot on the show, and I'm trying to make a concentrated effort to talk about them more, because I've realized how many men I tend to talk about and interview and things like that, which is fine too. Obviously, there's a lot of men who are allies in the movements for peace and justice and things like this. But we have to back up even more. If we're going to talk about women and Women's History Month, what is a woman? For this purpose, I'm going to be talking about sex rather than gender. So biologically different, biologically female persons, because really this idea of sex and gender being different, being separable from each other, is a pretty new idea in the broad recorded human history element of it. But I'll be talking about gender too, about more of the internal and how are the two connected. That's a huge topic all on its own, not one that I'm really prepared to attack today. But so I'm talking about biologically female persons. And why do those even exist? That's an interesting question. If we want to look at the U.S., which is kind of the cultural context I'm in, obviously, here in Spokane, Washington, right in the heart of the U.S. cultural happenings of all kinds, we are mainly influenced, some of us are influenced by science as our main understanding, kind of this like secular scientific idea of why things are the way they are. In theory, that's how we're operating. Christianity also has a huge, huge impact on our culture. And I think particularly in matters like this, even non-Christian people carry around some antiquated and damaging, originally deviated from Christianity and other patriarchal religions, ideas from those. So evolution-wise, I can't say that I am an expert on any of this, but on a basic level, I love the phrases that get used in this. I'm reading all these articles on evolutionary biology. I'm reading about evolution of sexual reproduction. Why are there women and men at all? And there's just really good phrases. Like, I want a band called The Twofold Cost of Sex, which is something I'll talk about in a second. But the basic premise is the reason that scientists believe that the basic reason why we have two sexes is to improve the quality of offspring, the fitness, despite reducing the overall number of offspring, which is the twofold cost of sex. If it takes two, if you have to find each other to continue on the lives of your offspring, it needs to also increase the awesomeness, the fitness of those offspring. So it creates genetic variation. It keeps, since we use selection for it, it keeps advantageous traits going in our species. Or if it's done properly, if we have people who are selecting in a conscious way. And it also keeps the population under control in theory, because, it takes two, because you have to search out, because it takes time for humans. Asexual reproduction would be much faster. We could just kind of repopulate at will. That's not really the topic that I want to focus on today, but it is interesting. And I think there's a lot to, if we just go to that basic level of how we evolved physically, we can learn a lot about why women and men might have evolved differently from a gender basis, based on their sex, based on the historical, the roles they've played based on their biology. Obviously, women generally have the ability to bear children. Men do not. And that is a huge one. So that keeps women in that role for a huge part of human history, that requires certain forms of nourishment that the men don't require. It requires the men to help in certain ways during those times, and it kind of ties women together in a common experience, and also excludes men from that common experience. So we can use that as a basic premise, I hope, moving forward. And yeah, that's a big part of it. The other part of it is, I keep closing tabs that I have open, but the part that I think is more powerful in our culture today is this other idea of, if you want to look at, I'm consistently shocked by the numbers of people who are going to look at the Bible in a literal fashion with horrible consequences. We were just listening to Max Blumenthal before this on alternative radio. If you heard that, he was talking about the state of Israel and about extreme extremists using religion as a basis for horrible oppression, using things like prophecy. And in very similar ways, I think Christianity has been distorted or used to oppress women historically in very dramatic and unfortunate ways. And based on the premise that, in Genesis, God decides to create man in his own image. Some more liberal theologians will tell you that that means man in the broad sense when we use it for both genders, and that humans are created in God's image. But then the woman is created from the man's rib, right? So women are derivative from the beginning there. It's part of, dependent on the man existing first and primarily. Then obviously we have the original sin question, that, and then we get the ideas that, women are kind of fundamentally not to be trusted. They're more, their curious nature is going to get them into trouble with Satan, things like that, that I think still really pervade our society. We have a lot of cultural caricatures, these common tropes that come up, characterizations of women as being manipulative, as using their seductive powers for evil, not to be trusted, or on the other side, that's one kind of woman that we get, who's usually the one who gets called a strong female character. The other kind being this very innocent, hyper-dependent on men, naive about the world in a way that's just really not believable most of the time, and therefore perfect. This is the woman who gets to be on the pedestal. So women are breaking into storytelling more than ever, I think. Some of those means have been democratized a little bit, and women are telling their own stories with greater frequency than in recent years, which is great. And hopefully we'll get some more interesting characters out of it. It's pretty frustrating to see, as a movie lover, a movie goer, it's frustrating to, not find very many characters that I can identify with other than ones who are male, which is fine in some ways. You can identify with another person's characteristics, with their goals, with the way they live their life without having the same sex as them. But it becomes pretty noticeable, I think, as a young girl, seeing that, wow, all these cool characters who I like tend to be men. What's up with that? And seeing the ways that manifests in real life. So kind of spinning out ahead of myself, but I just want to be thinking about these two influences of our actual evolution. Why did we end up the way we are, and how, with the point we're at in history, like how much do we need to be reliant on that, those biological sex differences, and this heavy Christian influence that we have in our culture that reinforce those myths. So, women's history as a separate entity. As I said in the introduction, it's Women's History Month, and that is good in some ways because we're talking about these interesting women in history. And I'm going to share a short video. Well, I'm going to share the audio with you that's about women and American history, because that's where I want to start. And there's people who have already done this work and made it very succinct in ways that I haven't done yet. So maybe I'll actually start here. Oh, I just tabbed back over to the Women's History Month website. And who should I see but Hillary Clinton, We'll talk about her in a moment. But Frida Kahlo was right after her, so it evens out, maybe. Anyway, I'm going to play this for you. It's called Songs of Herself, Women in American History. And it's Catherine Clinton talking at TEDx Belfast. So I'll play this for you, and then we'll talk about some more women's history. If you're just joining me, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. And Catherine Clinton is a...
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here in Belfast because it was quite a long road for me here. I began in the 1950s with a single mom who was wage earning in the Mad Men 50s in Middle America, trying to teach her daughter the new values that were blossoming. That is, that she could do anything she wanted as long as a woman, she did it twice as well as a man, and she would get half the credit. She had to learn to dance backward in heels so she could be complimented on her grace. But it was something that led me to feminism, that led me to thinking about how I could make a contribution in the second half of the 20th century. And so when I landed on these shores, welcomed here by the border police and found myself deported, I was thinking, payback for that voyage of my ancestors over from Ireland. But nevertheless, I thought it was a really remarkable thing for me, a Civil War historian, to come to Belfast in 2006, and shortly after I arrived, the Queen came over here in order to bid farewell to the British troops that had been here. And I thought, what an amazing thing to be here for a reconstruction, which was something that I had studied as a scholar, but now I might think about and perhaps contribute to. What lessons could American history, especially American women's history, bring to this region at this particular time? So at Queen's University, I reflected my most recent job as a chair professor of US history. I went back to my very first job. And when I was a newly minted master's, there was an economic downturn. And I put out my resume, like many of my students are today, and I found I only had two real choices. One was to return to the Great Plains to a post in Iowa, or I'd been offered a position teaching at the University of Benghazi in the Libyan Arab Republic. Well, I was 22. I was rather adventurous, and I thought this might be something to teach me some lessons. After all, as a Western feminist, where could you go but up after your teaching in an Islamic fundamentalist republic? But I did learn that the Northern Irish phrase, could be worse, was a little bit difficult because the worst that I encountered was as close as I want to come to worse. I was actually involved in a violent attack. I was beaten, I was raped, I was left half dead, and the police were involved suspiciously in this assault. It was something that really was traumatizing at the time, but it made me focus on survival instincts, on women, on how women shared experiences across the globe. It propelled me actually back into graduate school, where I earned an advanced degree working on sex and race on antebellum southern plantations. And I found myself eventually able to teach at my alma mater, Harvard, to do work on sexuality, a verb as well as a noun and a category, to work on race. And I was of the ilk that race was a social construction, something that didn't hit me as hard as it did when I came to Belfast to teach my own students these lessons that we actually create, invent images and realities. So I felt that lessons I was learning were going to propel women forward. Actually, weren't we going to take great leap forwards? But of course, as an historian, I could see patterns, I could see cycles, and see that for every leap forward, there might be two steps backwards. But it was, as we're learning, about the journey, about individuals, about trying to create a voice. And so, when I came here, struggling with accents, struggling with identifications, struggling with learning about communities, I found myself learning as much from my students as I hoped they were learning from me. Because each person in the classroom, man or woman, needs to learn their own voice, their own identity, how to construct themselves. And consciousness and education must go hand in hand. So I would teach lessons from American history, from the first American poet, who was Anne Bradstreet, who was often branded as a madwoman because she wanted to write and scribble and then even get published. And to this end, she said, "Who says my hand a needle better fits?" Or what about women like Sacagawea, the generation of Native women known as sleeping dictionaries, that were the translators, that were actually the guides, who were peacemakers, who brought the continent into settlement, trying to bring peoples together. And also, as a biographer, I'd worked on a first lady, Mary Lincoln. I'm not gonna dwell on her, as she's often stereotyped as first shopper or a madwoman, even though I'm trying to do my best to rehabilitate her. But I'm gonna look at someone else I wrote a biography of, Harriet Tubman, who was a favorite of a first lady who I know has visited here often with profit. That would be Hillary Clinton. When she was a New York senator, she did much to try to promote the cause of women by looking at this heroic woman. She was born a slave on the eastern shores of Maryland. She was put out to work at the age of 6. She was then subjected to harsh labor, subjected to all kinds of exploitation. When her owner died in 1849, she decided that she would run to freedom. Once she got that freedom in Philadelphia in abolitionist circles and was working, she struggled to bring freedom to others. She went back into enemy territory, into the slaveocracy, rescuing slaves in groups. She became known as the Moses of her people. During the Civil War, the governor of Massachusetts sent her into South Carolina, where she led raids, military actions, freeing hundreds of slaves at a time. And so Harriet Tubman was someone who I could bring to my students as someone who believed that only one person standing up to power could make a change in life. And it was these African American women that I have, in some ways, brought to my students as wonderful examples. And I'm going to close with the story of a woman who I hope most of you haven't heard of. She was a young girl born on a plantation near Spartanburg, South Carolina. Her name was Malvina. We don't have much beyond this early name. But we know she was a piece of property. She was given by her owner to his wife as a present. And that wife, upon her death, willed it to her daughter, who lived on a plantation in Georgia. So at the age of 6, this young black girl was transported like a piece of property to a plantation. Then we lose her record during the American Civil War. We know that she, like many of her generation, were subjected to harsh conditions on the road to emancipation. We know that she turns up in the record in 1870 with 4 children. One of them most likely was born to her, fathered by the son of her owner, a man named Shields. And we can trace these generations that one of her children, a son, ends up in Birmingham, Alabama, owning his own home, marrying, having his own children, and his children had children, and they begat children. I know I'm getting biblical here, but it ends when we see that that child born in Chicago was the grandfather of Michelle Obama, the current First Lady. And so no longer will African American women be downstairs in history, be below stairs, be subjected to the kind of stereotype and harsh oppression. But through struggle, through history, through learning about the past, we can come to a better future. So I'm not asking my students just to continue looking backward or stop looking backward. But as you turn your face backward, also pivot forward. Also look to the future and remember resistance, remember the great women that came before. And as Harriet Tubman, my hero, said, if you're tired, keep going. If you're hungry, keep going. Because if you want to taste freedom, keep going. And so I'm not going to sing a song of freedom, but I am going to close with a Belfast shout to all who return to the past in order to find a future, and think that our singer will actually be someone who can give us a nice song. Thank you very much.
So that was Catherine Clinton talking about women in American history. I hadn't listened to the whole end of that yet, and that was an interesting place for it to end on Michelle Obama, because that's she's one example of women I want to talk about. We talk about feminism, we talk about women's history, and as she said, you know, looking forward, not just looking backward at history, but where are we going next? And yeah, I guess as a Harvard historian, you know, she's much more likely to focus on kind of the future and the idea of progress as a positive that I wouldn't necessarily agree with. But still interesting. I really like that the title of that, which isn't shared, the title is Songs of Herself, which kind of speaks to what I was talking about at the beginning, this idea of stories being the fundamental human communication. I think, whether it's through song or through images or just through verbal storytelling, that's how we relate to each other. That's how we know that we're like or unlike others, is through telling stories, understanding our own stories. And oftentimes we do that through the lens of other people's stories. So when women's history is a separate entity from the rest of history, that alone gives you a pretty strong message about who women are in the culture. And yeah, it's the history of that is also pretty interesting, but I'm going to skip it for now and go back to this idea of, since we're talking about the U.S., there's obviously a big world out there and a lot of history of humans existing. But talking about U.S. history, there's, and I talk about this all the time on this show, and if you're a frequent listener, sorry for being redundant, but there's a lot of mythology, I think it's a very safe word to use in this case, around the Founding Fathers, about how great and different and special America is. American exceptionalism is what that's called. And this idea that the Founding Fathers just wanted freedom for everyone is pretty prominent. And there's people who really hold up the Constitution as like the best document ever. And they don't say like, it's like the best document ever, but It's really held up as this great example, but that leaves out the whole idea that these were rich land holding. They came and, you know, took it and split it up in various ways, and white slave owning, as she pointed out in that TED Talk. These were people who were totally fine with the idea of owning other people as property. Not really the people I want framing the documents that I base my life on. And also, importantly, every once in a while we'll hear about the, you know, the so-called founding mothers. We'll hear about Betsy Ross sewing the flag is the main part of the mythology I remember. You know, thank God the women were there to sew or we wouldn't have had a flag. And this is an article by Martha Burke that I'm going to share. She's the money editor at Miss Magazine. She is the director of the Corporate Accountability Project and the National Council of Women's Organizations. So those are all some of her affiliations. But she writes about the Constitution and women. So I'll just read her words. As we all learned in elementary school, our Declaration of Independence from the British Empire was adopted on July 4th, 1776. It declared that the 13 American colonies were now a new nation, the United States of America. Unfortunately, it also declared that, quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, end quote. And it meant just that. In the Constitution that followed, women were left out, not only no vote, but no equal rights of any kind. 4 months earlier, Abigail Adams had written to her husband John, a leader in the Continental Congress. In the new code of laws, she said, remember the ladies and be more generous than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. Adams, her husband, replied, I cannot but laugh. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. He spoke the truth. 100 years later, 4th of July in 1876, women still had no political, social, or economic rights, and they were left out of the official centennial celebration at the Philadelphia Exposition. Susan B. Anthony and 4 other suffragists crashed the opening ceremony to present their strongly worded Declaration of the Rights of Women. They were determined to place on record that for the daughters of 1976 the fact that their foremothers 100 years earlier had asserted that women ought to be equal under the law. Despite the suffragists' efforts, by 1976, women had gained one and only one constitutional right, the vote. Still no equal marriage rights, no equal economic rights, no equal educational rights, no equal inheritance rights, not even the right to petition for their children in divorce. Well, guess what? On this 237th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the daughters of 2013 still don't have equal constitutional rights with men, though many Americans think otherwise. The rights we have now are all statutory, not constitutional. That means a hostile Congress or Supreme Court could take them away in the dead of night. Think it couldn't happen? Need I mention the current assaults on abortion rights and birth control, the numerous attempts to overturn Title IX, and the Supreme Court's weakening of employment discrimination law? It has never in modern history been more clear that U.S. women need bedrock constitutional rights that cannot be eviscerated or taken away altogether. The Equal Rights Amendment has been introduced in Congress every year since 1923. It was voted out of Congress and sent to the states for ratification only once, in 1972. It failed 3 states short of the required 38 because, unlike other constitutional amendments, this one had an arbitrary 10-year ratification deadline. So, I'm going to stop there, but... And I may actually read that Declaration of the Rights of Women. I've read it before on the show, but it's pretty awesome. To load that up. So, obviously, Martha Burke and I don't agree on a lot of things, but if you want to be more conservative about the matter and just look at, you know, what are the documents, how is this whole thing, this whole project of the U.S. supposed to run, like, on paper, women are still... not part of the equation. So in all the ways that plays out, it isn't that surprising that embedded with the rest of the culture that women are offered the treatment that we are frequently offered. I just really like the John Adams quote that's in that article. That's the main thing I wanted to point out, and I'll reread it for you. So this is John Adams, one of the much beloved founding fathers. I cannot but laugh. Which is, you know, his wife is giving him this heartfelt request to, you know, hey, remember half of us over here? We bear your children, we do your dishes and sew your flags and all that. He said, I cannot but laugh. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. So that's pretty straightforward. I think men, the men who are part of upholding these systems of gender and sex-based oppression today are a little more savvy in that they don't come out and say that. They don't say, why would we give up this sweet deal? But that's pretty interesting to me that John Adams would just say that casually in a letter. I don't know if it were today, you know, would he tweet that and like broadcast it to everyone and not just his wife? Possibly not. I would really love to read a John Adams Twitter feed though. You know, he's being very open about it, and it's very pretty basic that's something he was open about. Sorry, I'm really, really multitasking here, which I should not be doing, trying to open that Declaration of Rights of Women. But that is an interesting period in history, and that's where a lot of Women's History Month tends to be focused, is on the suffragette movement, on the movement for women's suffrage and equality under the law, which originally was a set of demands that were much more robust than just the vote. It was about, you know, not being property. Women were also considered in the domain of their husbands under the law, much in the way that slaves were. So after slavery had been abolished, women were still property under the law. And so that was a big part of it. You know, for some reason, these women didn't want to be considered property. Rights of marriage, choice in marriage, parenting permissions, things like that. Help under the law in situations of abuse, and vote and representation being part of that. And a lot of the suffragettes we learn about, you know, Susan B. Anthony, they do these symbolic actions, these declarations. But there was also a much more radical suffragette history, and I've talked about it at much more length on previous shows, which I can link to in the notes for this podcast. But there is an article here that I found. Why did the suffragettes turn to violence? Because in many cases, the more radical elements of the suffragette movement, when things happened like another part of the movement, I suppose, that shouldn't be overlooked at the turn of the century is in the industrial U.S., women had become part of the economic system, being factory workers, particularly younger women in their teens to early 20s, and the conditions were not safe, and they were working long hours. They were subject to frequent assault, either at their workplace or on the way to and from their workplace. Tomorrow is actually the anniversary of the fire and disaster at the Triangle's shirtwaist factory. I think that is tomorrow. And that was a big, that was a flashpoint in this movement for more safe. It's the fourth highest loss of life still from an industrial accident in U.S. history. And caused the death of 146 garment workers, mostly women, 123 women who died in the fire. Most of them were recent immigrants, aged 16 to 23, and the owners had locked the doors to the stairwells and exits. They could not escape the burning building, and it was quite a disaster. So that was one example of the working conditions that these women were working to change. And oftentimes, they employed the traditional means. They appealed to the better sensibilities of the men around them to try to help them, have the men use their greater concentration of power within the system itself to change it. They wrote letters. They wrote petitions. They gave speeches on the streets. But when those methods proved slow, in the face of things like this actually happening, in the face of assault happening all the time, this industrial disaster being one eventuality of the conditions they were working under, as it became more and more urgent, many of these women were totally openly okay with violence as a tactic. And there were various offices that were bombed, that were firebombed, and these women are taking this on. You have to remember the dress code, you know, wearing full skirts, not impractical shoes, and choosing to do this. So one of the questions is why would they do that? And in some ways it backfired slightly, because it fanned the flames of the idea of women being irrational and being emotional and hysterical, and these kinds of labels that have been put on women for a long time. So this article talks about why would they do that. So this is, they say why they did it. They use the same arguments that were being used by the peaceful campaigners for the vote. This is a quote from Emmeline Pankhurst. She said, "I was a poor law guardian, and I shall never forget seeing a little girl of 13 lying in a bed playing with a doll. I was told she was on the eve of becoming a mother, and she was infected with a loathsome disease. Was that not enough to make me a militant suffragette? We women suffragists have a mission, to free half the human race, and I incite this meeting to rebellion." For them, at the time, it was so obvious that situations like that were so outrageous that something had to be done, and violence was a natural, even normal, reaction. We need to start off by considering the underlying reasons why these women were seeking the vote, stressing how vital and basic a civil right it was, before we move to the specific reasons why certain women turned to violence. If the underlying cause had not been there, or had not been so massively important, there would have been no need for violence. These are some suggestions, and this is by John Clare, by the way. I should have mentioned that. Pent-up anger is one of his suggestions why some turn to violence. They become fed up with being written off by the men. The suffragettes had existed since 1903, but the first official violent suffragette incident occurred in 1909 when Mrs. Bouvier and a number of others threw stones at the Home Office windows. She wrote in the Suffragettes magazine, Votes for Women, quote, "We had decided that the time for political arguments was thoroughly exhausted, and we made up our minds that the time for militant action had arrived. We decided to wait till 9 o'clock, when we could be sure the peaceful deputation headed by Mrs. Pankhurst had been arrested. Then we determined to show our action what we thought of the Prime Minister in refusing these ladies admission to the House of Commons. That was our motive for throwing stones at the windows." Hannah Mitchell, a suffragette who wrote an autobiography called The Hard Way Up, summed it up. "The smoldering resentment in women's hearts burst into the flame of revolt." In this interpretation, violence is presented as a reaction to the repression of the past. A second reason is to force men to give way. They consciously adopted violence as a way to influence the men. Emmeline Pankhurst said, "The argument of the broken pane is the most valuable argument in modern politics." In this interpretation, violence was a cold, conscious tactic. There is a lovely letter to the Daily Telegraph dated February 26, 1913, which reads, "This is by Bertha Brewster. Everyone seems to agree upon the necessity of putting a stop to suffragist outrages, but no one seems certain how to do so. There are only two ways in which this can be done. One, kill every woman in the United Kingdom. Two, give women the vote. Yours truly, Bertha Brewster." The third reason could be publicity. They were after the Associated publicity to get into the newspapers. They were after the partyr of martyrdom. Many suffragette stories openly admit that it was exhilarating. It was a bit of a lark to break windows, as though they were playing hockey. And for some women, the campaign for the vote was part of a wider bid for a radical social revolution. A suffragette called Teresa Billington Grieg was at the same time a trade unionist and an organizer of the Infant Labor Party. She said, "I shall be a militant rebel to the end of my days." She left WSPU in 1911 because she felt that militancy has been degraded from revolution into political nonsense. It apes rebellion. Similarly, Christabel Pankhurst broke with her mother and sister and moved into the East End of London to accomplish what she considered real social as well as political revolution in women's lives. So that's focused on both Britain and the U.S., but talks about the variety of reasons why women would be after more radical action. And the main reason I want to read that, I didn't preface that very well, but is that the focus of official Women's History Month is going to be on gaining the vote. That's the focus. It's about women in mainstream politics. It's about women who are succeeding in the ways that the culture and system that we have in place now wants women to succeed. Female CEOs, you know, Sheryl Sandberg has become a popular person to reference. This whole idea that's floating out there of reclaiming the word bossy and changing the way we label young girls with that term. So she'll be held up. You know, Hillary Clinton, as I said, popped up on the forefront of that article. And at the same time, so women who are filling socially acceptable and not revolutionarily threatening roles, such as Secretary of State and likely presidential nominee, in Hillary Clinton's case, CEO of Fortune 500 company. Certainly, Fortune 500 companies don't threaten the status quo of global industrial capitalism, right? Which both of those, the premise, you know, the U.S. empire is explicitly anti-feminist. Global industrial capitalism is anti-feminist because when these two systems, which support each other inextricably, right, when they are unleashed throughout the world and here, women suffer more than the men do under that. They suffer different kinds of injustice. They suffer double layers of oppression under systems like that. Obviously, it's no picnic for the men either, and it's not really a contest of who suffers more than whom, but it's also important, I think, that we don't let these women who are accomplishing things within the structures that we have, you know, the woman whose speech I played earlier, talking about Michelle Obama, she's the first lady, but she's the first lady of a country that is, you know, her husband, who in theory she can talk to at any moment about this, is personally authorizing drone strikes on wedding parties, you know, on normal people and perhaps on criminals alike, but using these kinds of methods that the most powerful military empire in history would use, it cancels out, at least in my mind, it cancels out your other qualifications as a feminist or a person who cares about equality. Because if you don't care about equality for everyone in the world, if you only care about equality for American women in American systems, then that's not really enough, and it's quite hypocritical and really damaging in a lot of ways. So there have to be ways to get around that. The other category of women that I think will be held up are women who, so Harriet Tubman is an example, Women's History Month, Susan B. Anthony, also an example. These are women who, during their own time, you know, broke the law, broke with social norms, put themselves at great risk. As I said, the theme this year is women of character, courage, and commitment. They broke the rules. They put their lives at risk to accomplish things that they cared about. For Susan B. Anthony, it was equality of the sexes. For Harriet Tubman, it was ending slavery and freeing people from slavery. She was, you know, a really talented organizer making that happen. But I think that those women are included because those movements are safely part of, they've been incorporated into the story, the big story of what the U.S. is, right? So in the case of Susan B. Anthony, she can be pointed to as an example of, see, because of her breaking the law then, everything, this is all safely, it's all safely blocked into the past. And now women have the vote, and isn't that great? It keeps us from having the conversation about, well, what is having the vote really got for women? Is there equal representation in our political system? There's not at all. It's highly unbalanced. You'd think that with 51% of the population, if equal representation worked the way it's supposed to, if representative government worked in the way it's intended to, then, you know, 51% or close to of the people in the political machine would be women. And it's not, it doesn't turn out that way at all. It's drastically fewer than that. And so there's that. So Susan B. Anthony is part of the safe story of the past because it's done. It's a book that can be closed from the establishment's perspective. And then she can be held up as an example of American progress, right? That allows us to ignore the rest of it. Similarly with Harriet Tubman, we can talk about how brave she was and how, you know, the really great accomplishments that she had in her life, all while overlooking the fact that I think the reality of slavery, it's part of the story that kind of glosses over how horrifying that history is and how I don't think that most Americans, especially maybe in this region too, we're not in the South. It's kind of like a part of the mythology again. And so someone like Harriet Tubman can be held up now because in the formalized sense, slavery is over. But I just imagine, like, what if there were women who, what about women like, I'm trying to think of, what if there were women advocating and breaking the law in order to accomplish the goal of abolishing prisons, you know, destroying the prison industrial complex. And to do this, they were breaking into those prisons and freeing prisoners. And, you know, maybe they could focus on nonviolent drug offenders. And they were going in and liberating nonviolent drug offenders from prisons and smuggling them out through a system of underground support houses where they passed them from place to place and got them to a place where they could be free and properly rehabilitated and reintroduced into society as a protest against the for-profit industrial prison system. I don't think if a woman was leading that, she would be held up today as a great leader, an example of the kind of women we want our daughters to be. She'd probably be branded a terrorist and probably be hunted by the U.S. government. Maybe that's not the best example, but I just think it's interesting how history can be used by different people, by people in power and people not in power, to tell the stories that we want to be told. So there are women now, you know, that are awesome, that are doing work like this, that are kind of taking apart some of the arrangements that we have today. And there have been women like that for a long time, but they aren't women that are likely to be held up anytime soon by the official website for Women's History Month. And those are the conversations I'm interested in having. I want to, at some point, have my friend Kelly on, who's starting the Spokane Feminist Forum. There's been a lot of, there's a lot brewing, I think, in Spokane specifically around women, women's, what I guess can be called women's issues that are really everyone's issues, around gender politics, around gender identity, around just relations of all kinds of people. And especially around the media, which I think is an important part of the story. So, and it's something I am personally kind of torn about. I just went to a panel last week that the Gonzaga and Whitworth Women's and Gender Studies departments put on together about music videos, women, and sexual agency. And similarly to, I think there's been a big focus, partially, rightly so, on advertising and the way that women are depicted in the world of advertising, how women's bodies are used to sell all manner of products, most of which have very little to do with women's bodies, but using that those tactics of objectification to sell things is really interesting. It's been a big focus over the last, I think, probably 15 years, maybe more, of feminism, especially as our culture becomes more and more image driven, more images, fewer words, the world of pictures, you know. It's interesting to see how that tactic has worked largely. And most people believe, including myself, that they're smarter than advertising, right? And that you don't just buy something because you see it on television, or you don't buy a specific brand of alcohol because there's a sweaty, mostly naked woman, you know, caressing the bottle in an advertisement. But to some extent, it continues, and it continues to become more intense as people are desensitized to the previous layer of advertising, right? So even if you're not affected by it, even if you're a media literate person, meaning that, which I think should be a high priority for schools, and it's not present in hardly any school curriculum. That's what I did a final project on in school, was about the idea of media literacy and what that is and why it's important to teach young people. And the basic idea is to be a media literate person. You have a basic knowledge of symbolism, of you know, the shorthand that is visual images, of history of those images and symbols, and you have the tools to analyze what you're seeing in the media. So it's more than just being able to read, more than being able to see or hear, but to really look at an advertisement that you might drive past every single day, and look at what are the elements of it. What is it trying to tell me? What is it telling me about the people involved in this image? And that's really powerful to be able to do. And I think that people really do need to do that. And that, so rightly so, that's been a focus of feminist discussion, is this objectification of women. You know, if the only characters you see that share your sex in films and television are, you know, primarily sexy as a characterization, what does that tell you about how you're supposed to be? If those are categories, if the categories are smart or pretty, what are you supposed to choose? If there aren't women having relationships with other women, there's a famous test, you know, the Bechdel test, that you can run movies through in all kinds of media. It's three simple questions. Is there more than one woman in the story? Meaning, is there more than one female character who has a name? That's the qualification. Do the women speak to each other? And when they speak to each other, do they speak about something other than a man? And it's pretty difficult to find films that pass. I think it's becoming less difficult, maybe, as film equipment becomes more accessible, as kind of the old guard of arts communities becomes older and just simply dies off. Sorry, that's how it's happening. And I think the internet has been a tool for women's voices being amplified. The trick is to get the culture to understand women's full humanity, meaning mostly the men of the culture who have been enculturated with these this consistent objectification of women and dehumanization of women, and also just the mislabeling of women, the oversimplification of them and of us and our stories. I'm one of them. And here's actually a great quote about that. I'm kind of going on a little rant about the media and the way women are portrayed. But the basic idea that I want to get across here is moving into the future, outside of the history of women, we change the culture. That's what culture is. We all make it together. So I think it's really important to start to understand these things, to discuss them openly, and for women to create more, and for men to support the things that women create, and for men to look at what they create and see how it depicts women, and think about if it's expressing the full humanity of all of the people involved. And here's a quote from Gloria Steinem, whose birthday is also tomorrow. She probably said this in the 60s, she said, "Any woman who chooses to behave like a full human being should be warned that the armies of the status quo will treat her as something of a dirty joke. That's their natural and first weapon. She will need her sisterhood." I would say sister and brotherhood. That's something that I think feminism as a big capital F institution is starting to approach more, is that a lot of the impetus to change, a lot of women understand what it is to be a woman in our culture. They understand that it's real because they face the abuse, the physical, sexual assault rates that are just incredibly high. The more conservative number is 1 in 6. So if you think about all the women that you encounter in your day, from your family to your friends to your coworkers to random people you pass on the street, depending on what density of population you live in, that's dozens to hundreds of women who are in that real situation. Every day that you see, you know, and that's a serious problem. I shouldn't have to say that, obviously, but that's something we should be concerned about as a society and a culture. And so from that, you know, women understand these things on a basic level because they're on the receiving end of this cultural hierarchy that we have that is called patriarchy. For men to understand it, it's more, I think men, as they have the power in the system now, they can help change the culture in a very meaningful way that I think has been left out some of the time. So, and here's actually, Gloria has something to say about that too. She said, "We've begun to raise daughters more like sons, but few have the courage to raise our sons more like our daughters." So those ideas of empathy, the traits that are generally considered to be female traits of nurturing and listening and supporting are things that it would be great for our society if the boys and men were raised that way too. All the people raised that way, rather than this idea of kind of, you know, I was raised in the 90s and, you know, the Spice Girls and girl power. And it was really about domination, I think, in a lot of ways. It's, you know, you go and get it. You go and climb the ladder and wear the big boots, and, you know, you can stomp out anything. And it's pretty aggressive. And I see that manifesting in women of my generation who have a lot of anger, which is fine. You know, I'm angry too. But a lot of times it gets manifested as aggression. Ugh. So we have a lot to work on. And that's what I'll likely be talking about next week, is how we can move forward. So we're talking about women's history today, sort of. It was a little bizarre and jumbled, and I hope you forgive me and you stuck with me for it. But then we'll be talking next week about the future. How do we shape this new way of being? And my person, if we're going to talk about politics in the U.S., I'd much rather talk about Winona LaDuke. She's a good example. Native American female activist who has run for various public offices. I'm going to finish with a quote of hers that's about racism, and it's also about gender and these power dynamics, and about creating culture. She said, "One of our people in the Native community said the difference between white people and Indians is that Indian people know they are oppressed but don't feel powerless. White people don't feel oppressed but feel powerless. Deconstruct that disempowerment. Part of the mythology that they've been teaching you is that you have no power. Power is not brute force and money. Power is in your spirit. Power is in your soul. It's what your ancestors, your old people, gave you. Power is in the earth. It is in your relationship to the earth." So there's some wisdom from a woman I'm very fond of. And with that, I'm going to take off. If you like the show, you can find the podcast at kyrs.org. And it's under Programs, Praxis, Podcasts. Podcasts, Praxis, other way around. You can also find the full archive at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. The podcast of this show will be up later today, and you can check it out there. You can also follow on Facebook at facebook.com/praxisradio. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.